You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
This is Quantum Leap Book Club, and our regular host, Parisha, will not be joining us tonight as she's traveling and teaching. So her co-hosts will cover tonight's material. Our co-hosts are Geraldine Dalby Ball, environmental biologist from Sydney, Australia, Trina Cooper, lifelong entrepreneur from Denver, Colorado, Rosemary Heyer, English teacher working with children in Frankfurt, Germany, Dr. Joyce Mullenhauer, doctor of naturopathy in Kingman, Arizona, and myself, Marianne Love, psychologist from Melbourne, Australia. Our book this week is Mind into Matter by Fred Alan Wolfe. We're in chapter 4 and we'll be discussing pages 50 to 58 tonight, and we're broadcasting through Law of Attraction Radio Network. So let's begin. Now, this is such a powerful book and a huge chapter. Like, we could spend a long time getting our heads around simple statements reflected here. So I think it's going to be a lively discussion today. So Trina, I know you wanted to share on that first symbol that he offered at the start of this chapter.
I did, and I appreciate being here with all of you tonight. In chapter 4, we start with Dalit. And Dalit represents resistance or response to movement. So if we remember that we had alpha, which was the beginning, the first thing, the spirit, and then we went into Beit, which was the material, then we went to Gimel, which was the movement, and now we're going to the response to movement. So it says, Dalit represents the resistance or response to movement. It appears as the interaction between material objects in states of motion. It responds to all the Gimel movement of the Beit's matter containing Aleph, spirit. Dalit appears as the common inertia of materials, and it plays a vital role in the universe. It is the recorded response or resistance that is continually offered to Gimel motion. The prefix re, as in words like recall, remember, resist, or response, is pure Dalit. And I just wanted to touch on inertia, a definition of inertia, because that's what we're talking about here. And inertia is the tendency to do nothing or to remain unchanged. And we're going to have a lot of discussion about this in this chapter. It's a property of matter by which constitutes in its existing state of rest or uniform motion. So if something was in a straight line, moving in a straight line, it's not going to move off the straight line until it's bumped by something. Or, as far as ourselves are concerned, we may stay in the same state until we get bumped. And we get bumped by a movement, we get bumped by something that happens to us, and that starts to push us out of the inertia. There's a resistance there, but we begin to move. So it's usually an external force is what the definition says, but we'll find out more about that as we go into the chapter. So Dalit is really now beginning to take a look at what happens as all the movement begins to happen.
Yes. Thank you for that. And I think it's a powerful reflection to look at what does inertia mean in the context of us creating our realities, because that's what this book is really all about, is what is the true nature of existence and where do we fit in to that, and what's that sense of I in the context of the one and the wholeness. And it's a bit to get your head around, and I know all of us are just working at chipping away at our understanding and application of that. So it'd be really great if people have reflections on how they've applied this, what it means to you, experiences you've had with this, wins, you know, losses, all those things would be really interesting to hear the stories about. And I thought in the start of chapter 4, he talks about inertia as the mysterious resistance. And I think that's so true, because we find it very hard to name it and to really see it for what it is. But it invites us to think about, who is this I am? He says at the beginning, I think, therefore I am. Or is it I am, therefore I think? Which one does come first? Or maybe are they co-creating each other? And so he talks about, you know, mind creates. Does mind influence matter, or is matter influencing matter? So, you know, like you drop an egg on a ground, the ground definitely would influence the egg. That would be matter influencing matter. Or does matter influence mind? Like if you take some drugs or alcohol, we're definitely having our mind influenced by matter in that instance, you know. And I think he really gets us looking at, who is this I am? Like, what is this I experience that we call and feel as individual from everyone and everything else? And he talks about that being this boundary between the real and the imaginal realms. And what I thought was really interesting about this, as a psychologist, you know, I'm constantly dealing with even my own and other people's sense of isolation, loss, lack, separateness, the pain that comes with this separate I. And he talks about in Buddhism the fact that everyone feels this suffering as soon as you identify with this sense of I as separate from the whole or the one, and yet it's in it's wired in our very nature to have this idea of individual separate from, and comes from that experience of where that boundary is between the imagined and the real. Real as in, I guess, my understanding of real is in the 3D realm, or the realm we sense with our physical senses, is what I would think is what he's talking about real, but somebody else might have another idea about that, and I'm happy to hear various opinions, because I think that's the essence of us learning and understanding and sharing. But so I think once we can get our head around, you know, who's influencing who, what is the I am, you know, and where does that all fit in, then we can actually then direct it and determine our outcomes and not be victims to a past or a pre-programmed destiny that's wired in the brain from our own history and lifetime experiences, that we don't just keep recreating our future because it was wired in our past. So I know there's lots of people that want to share today. And who would like to go next? And has there any reflections on that? Or would you like to just keep going and discussing the material? Who would like to speak next?
This is Geraldine in Sydney, Australia. Oh. That thing about something being wired, and combines us with when we understand the other modern science, for example, that parts of the brain. So when we say if we've had a traumatic experience, that will go into a part of the brain that is not necessarily so-called logical. So it's harder to then use logic to release it. And if we're going to keep recreating, because that's a pattern that we can see as we think we create, then we do need some of those tools where we can stop and say, oh, okay, sometimes I need a reflection. If I'm still experiencing this in my life, then I am creating it, even if you can't logically see why you would think or want that. So as we experience, that's the most direct teacher we can have. If we don't like what we're receiving, then it's time to say, what am I putting out?
Absolutely. Thank you. And Gabrielle, I see you want to share. What would you like to?
I was looking at the sense of aloneness that come, you know, with the definition of who I am in the relation of the world. And I just wanted to relate it to our current health crisis. Where I live in Victoria, Australia, we had various stages of lockdown, which meant people weren't allowed to leave their homes to socialize, to go to work even. And what I've observed that a lot of people had to confront is like, who am I in relation to the world? Because they were forced to. There was no business, so to speak, where people could go about their lives as usual. They often had to stay home on their own or with their family, and were confronted with that inner research. So what I've observed is that it did go both ways. Some people totally withdrew into themselves, and their sense of aloneness, so to speak, became even stronger. There, you know, some people had increased their alcohol intake, stopped exercising, watched a lot of commercial TV, while others used their time in saying, I'm going to connect no matter what. So through social media, they're connected more than ever with families, let's say. And others took it even further to overcome that inertia that this isolation kind of probably put us all in for a while, and said, I'm going out there. I'm teaching meditation. I'm going to share the songs and the music I make at home. I'm going to share my increased appreciation for the world by filming the butterfly that I've just seen, by filming my baby laughing, and in that have really overcome that. So it was very beautiful to watch, you know, especially the later part where people went out even more than ever.
I think that's a really good point there about it. As you mentioned, it's overcoming an inertia. And inertia, we can sometimes think is this difficult thing, but actually if we see that it's that part that allows us to be everything we can, then it really helps. And who else have we got?
I was also thinking about what was in the very beginning of this chapter, where they said that science can't prove that mind exists, but mind exists because we know it. And that to me was kind of fascinating, especially for hardcore scientists that want to prove something and it's not real unless they can prove it's real and all of that. Yet they're thinking, yet they're coming up with their hypothesis with mind. And we all know that we think, and we all know that there's something there that we're thinking with. But I found it kind of, my friend calls it a mind pretzel. It's kind of a funny statement, but that it sort of takes you around and circles you around. Because if you want to prove mind, how do you go about doing that, even though you know that you're using it? So it's just kind of a funny topic that he threw in here in the middle of it, and something to ponder.
It certainly is. And I know Dr. Joy Mollenhauer has
This is my favorite chapter in the whole book. And I'll tell you my personal example with it in a minute. But to build on what Trina said about the mind, the question is, does it exist in the brain? Well, there's absolutely no objective evidence. And he uses the example that when a person dies, does it mean that the brain held the mind because no longer exists? Well, it's the same as taking the air out of a tire and the tire no longer rolls. So there really is no proof that that's true. And then in the medical and the science fields, there's been this historical rigidness that unless it can be proven, they don't believe it. So in this book, Dr. Wolf puts out the statement that he believes intuitively, we all know that the new alchemy is possible. Now, maybe people don't express in their mind those exact thoughts, but more and more people are recognizing in their own heart, you don't need to have scientific proof in front of you to know something is true. So I love the fact that creation and transformation cannot happen unless there's inertia, unless there's resistance. And I began to think of all the examples in my life about watching birth, for instance, watching a beautiful butterfly come out of a chrysalis, watching our breath. Like if someone really pays attention to breathing in and breathing out, and you're making it your object to drink, to breathe deeply, you get resistance as you try and take more in. You get resistance when you try to breathe out. So all of this is so positive and powerful. And my personal example with this was 12 years ago when I came to Kingman, Arizona for 3 days to get myself employment. Well, I got to the evening of my second last day and I didn't have employment settled. And I got myself into this total emotional state. And I picked up this book and read about inertia. And I realized I was hitting resistance. And all I needed to recognize is that the resistance was going to be my gift. And the next day, I obtained employment. So I just find it's a fabulous statement. And we've heard from our elder that if there's no growth, if there's no discomfort, then you're stagnant and you're dying. So let's all celebrate every time we feel resistance, break through it, and get the reward of the breakthrough.
Thank you, Joyce. I'm back on. I think I had my own little bit of resistance there somehow, got bumped off. So I missed a little bit, but I know you guys, I'm sure, has been free-flowing there and great sharing. So who would like to share next?
This you, is
Veronica?
Rosemary.
Great.
Yes.
Oh, Rosemary. Okay, no, we had Veronica, sorry, jumped on there first. Let's go, Veronica.
One of the things that I certainly wanted to share, speaking of resistance and certainly speaking of from last week, the in here and out there, how I'm using and learning so much about being in the moment. And what moment am I in? Am I in the moment of my feelings? And if I'm in the moment of my feelings, I'm certainly in the past. I am in what has been learned. I am in the emotions. And all of that has been acquired through the lived experience. And what is happening right now, right today, in this moment? What am I pushing through? What am I breaking from? The resistance of old past patterns. What do I want? What is my focus right now, right today? And I've certainly learned in the past 3 weeks, I want to say, you can't even look at yesterday. Yesterday has nothing to do with this moment right now, unless you decide you want to live in the past. It doesn't even matter what you want to add up from yesterday or because of yesterday's, this is happening. None of that matters. What matters is right now, what are you doing? Right now, what are you choosing? Right now, what actions are you taking? Right now, how are you flowing with it all? And it allowed me to see, how much of my right now-ness had everything to do with my past, had everything to do with my lived experiences, and had nothing to do with my choices right now. That's what I wanted to share.
Thank you. Powerful. And Rosemary, you had something to share. What was that?
Yes, hello. This is Rosemary from Frankfurt, Germany. And I want to speak a little bit to the dichotomy he's sharing and how we can get out of this. Something like what Veronica said, but in a different way, that there is always the opposition of what we know, how Veronica described it, and how we stay in the moment and create. So he's speaking about dichotomy, which means he says that there's an opposition always present, or other philosophers call it the dialectic situation. There's always a plus and a minus, and there is body and mind, and there is outer and inner, And he says that we need to go into the imaginal to really create. And we can only cross this dichotomy if we are becoming aware of that split. If we're becoming aware of both the real, the matter, the body, and the mind. So first of all, it's awareness. But we cannot just stay there. This is just the first step. And it's not going to really help us to create. And what comes to me is we can't stay there because we usually come from matter. And I remember some of the teachings of Dr. Joe, who says we cannot change matter with matter. Means we cannot change matter with that what we already have in our body as our preconceived notions, beliefs, or frequencies. We do need to leap or jump into the imaginal realm. We need to basically have a leap of faith into the unknown. And he speaks about that later in the end of this chapter, that we have to go into the unexpected. That's how he calls it. And so he says that resistance is really important to arise out of that staleness. So we need that to become aware each time when we feel a resistance arising within us. We need to become aware of that split. And that resistance, I really like, there's a sentence I really like, which is actually my main sentence of the chapter. He says, there is no inertia greater than mind. So what does that mean? My understanding of that is that inertia, which is a principle of the universe, everything first has an inertia, that it is part of my mind, my understanding, my beliefs, my identification, which creates the resistance too. And I have to jump over that to move into the realm of the future, to move, to use my intuition, to use my deeper understanding, my in there, my magical thinking, so to speak, to move out of that. Well, I hope I got a little bit more clearer on that than it's in the book, because it's quite a challenge for me to understand, and I'm curious to hear what other people have to say.
Yeah, powerful. Thank you. And I'm really reflecting on what does that mean, the inertia, and how is it relevant? And I think about some of the client work that I do, because I sit in observation of that, it might be easier for me to reflect on. And then I think, well, if he's saying that our mind is our biggest resistance or inertia, like when I see that with clients, it's when there is an old and often unconscious pattern there, and they'll come to me because they keep repeating something, like they might keep attracting really nasty men or situations that just keep repeating themselves, and or they find themselves in relationships, they just can't speak up. And then when you do the inner work of tapping that unconscious space, I've always found the program. There's always a program, or it usually comes with a big emotional charge on it that relates to an old experience that's set outside their conscious awareness. Like, for example, situations where they didn't feel heard or listened to at home, and so they felt they didn't matter because they weren't listened to, and because that the conflict around that and the emotions go so deeply into the unconscious, they just keep acting out and finding partners who just live that same pattern because fundamentally they don't feel valuable enough to be heard. And it's only when I've noticed that they've come to their own awareness, and sometimes they're shocked by what comes up. They're shocked by the feelings that are there and the truth that's within them. And from that point, they move past it. They make a new decision. But I think it's this thing of, like, we can logically make a new decision. And if there is a big unconscious bank there making the majorities of the decision, then that will be the resistance that we need to overcome. And I think it's that value of, noticing the patterns, noticing how they're acting out, and then using that to dive deeper into where in my unconscious, if it's not conscious, am I making that choice? And then release those emotions so a new choice can be easily made, a new truth is integrated. So it's sort of getting all the parts of unconscious self whole and integrated so new decisions can be made. And I think for me, that's what some of this points to, that the resistance is within the unconscious. I don't know, some other people may have different reflections on that. It'd be wonderful to hear. some other people's thoughts about that. I think Geraldine had something she wanted to share now about some of the pages in the chapters.
Yes, and it does link directly with what you were saying there, that we can have a resistance and it may not be seen. But as you're saying, it's the releasing of that that allows us to create new. And that's what the figure, there's a figure on page 57, it's called figure 4.1, and it's an Escher, it's an artist, Escher, who's got a drawing with one hand drawing the other hand. And what it's really, I mean, as any piece of artwork, the beauty is that whatever you see in that is true for you. But in terms of what we're looking at in the book, let's say we have one of those experiences and it is hidden in our so-called subconscious, that is still drawing our reality unless we find it and say, oh, I see you. We're going to now draw it differently. And what happens is that one hand that's drawing that particular reality, like as Marianne just shared, it might be attracting a particular type of relationship. So you've got one hand drawing that, you know, is an outcome, a particular type of partner. And then because there's that particular type of partner, it's then influencing our thoughts, feelings, emotions. And in a way, it's strengthening that way of being. It's strengthening that belief. And then because that belief is strong, the belief then goes on to draw again. So what we're looking at is internal world drawing the external world. The external world is then showing the internal world that what it was being the artist of has come into realization. And so you can get this self-fulfilling prophecy, which doesn't have to be bad. It just means because we understand it now and we know this is a process, let's choose to be the artist on both sides. Let's say, okay, I'm going to practice and rehearse and change my internal chemistry so that even my so-called subconscious self is drawing the reality that I want. And when I see that in the environment, that's why the morning affirmation of today, my eyes will see 1,000 beautiful things. That's then you telling your physical self in the external world to see the beauty. That beauty then gets reflected back to our mind and our thoughts. And it's a self-fulfilling cycle that we actually see more beauty. So if you see those hands, it doesn't mean you're stuck in a cycle. It means you choose in your thoughts to see it in the external world. You see it in external, you can re-strengthen the thoughts. Internal and external is intricately linked. And that's it's a beautiful picture and a beautiful thought that reminds us we are both the artists of our internal world and what we choose to experience in our external world.
Thanks very much. And who else would like to share? I know we have so many of you beautiful people on the line. Who would like to go next? Robbie. Yes, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Yeah, loud and clear.
I wanted to ask you, Marianne, something about, well, if you stay in resistance. Like, for example, I can think about there are times when I need to write up like a scope of work for a job that I have to give to a developer, and it'll be a really complex one where I need to have a lot of reference material, I need to find a lot of screenshots, and it's just generally a lot of thinking and a lot of work to put it together. So I'll resist doing that, even though I know that it's, you know, slowing down the process of delivering the finished product to the client, I'm still resisting it. And as I continue to resist it, I just feel more and more exhausted, more and more stressed out over it. And finally, when I get past my resistance, it'll be like a rush of energy because it's done and it's moving. And there's when you were talking about it, I was wondering, like, why, when there are things going on in our lives that we know will be good for us or that will keep us on track with our core purpose or things like that, why do we hold on to that resistance for a long time?
That's a good question, and I think everyone can reflect on that personally and go a long way with it. But honestly, I think that we're holding on really to an old program. So when you say it's hard, that story of it's hard creates the experience of it's hard, and therefore we avoid hard because, well, of course we want to be comfortable. No one wants to feel like life's hard. And so then we keep creating that experience. And I don't know about you, Robbie, but I often use that pressure, the feeling of pressure, to catapult me past the inertia. And I rely on that to get things done and to focus sometimes. But, you know, just getting conscious of that, then I realize, well, I'm choosing a path of hardship because could it just have been fun and easy and playful and light? And that would have been my choice and your choice. So I think in that, then we'd have to look at our own story of what it's creating the inertia. And is the inertia a sense of we're not getting something done, like an awareness that something could be different from what it currently is? Like, some people, I think, are in a state and have no awareness of the state. Like, I guess we all are. I say some people, like it's not me. No, we're all in a state and we are often not aware of the state. And so, and at that point, are we in inertia? This is questions, really. Are we in inertia, or are we only in inertia when we're aware of a state that we could be better in or could feel lighter or happier in, and it's different from our current state? And is that when this motion of inertia is occurring? So it's sort of, what's the question is actually, what is the inertia? What is inertia in our perception and our experience? But, you know, I think, Rosie, you're talking about programming, you know, storylines that we can all identify with and we can all overcome, you know, to be free of those stories, create a new one. The story of it's easy.
That's great. I really appreciate it.
Who else would like to share?
I'd love to.
Great, Mary.
On the top of page 56, just going along from there, and I'm going to interject this so we can all ponder and come up with a response to what you just asked. And the book says, when the universe becomes aware of a rising resistance, the same resistance you and I experience when we discover a new idea, the universe comes into being and becomes self-aware. It transforms information into matter, giving rise to physical objects, and transforms matter into information, giving rise to a mental universe that models the physical. Resistance arises in each transformation. So, and we can go on, and again, he refers to the impossible to imagine self-referential loop of creator. And here, when he's talking about, like, inertia, resistance, he's talking about it comes up with every time we have a transformation. And when he's talking about transformation, he's talking about being able to go from the one hand and the other hand. We've got an idea, information, into matter, and matter into information. So if we can imagine, I'm asking for help here in imagining what he's meaning here. Is because what got us out of the inertia to have the idea that then transforms into matter because it's a new idea. That then when we think about it, that means that we've had a self-referential experience, which means that we've gotten out of inertia and into matter. So, it goes back and forth. We have this looping back and forth. So I'm can read the words and could use a little more assistance in understanding how that new idea arose in the first place for us to have resistance and then transformation?
That's a great question, Mary.
I like that one.
I mean, for me, I think there he spoke about it before, this element of desire, hasn't he? And what is desire? This, you know, internal drive, like this force that wants something to be different. And I think as humans, we're such creative visualizers. We're just wonderful imaginers of what this reality could be. And we see beauty all around us if we choose to. I mean, the planet is beautiful. And I think we get inspired by that, and our spirit, you know, is inspired for this transformation into beauty on this planet. And I think there are so many forces driving that. And so I'm not sure, for me, that's what this partly means is, you know, there's a, you know, is that related to the oneness that we all are, you know, and as our individual minds that we have got the power to create and vision something new? Because I know, well, as soon as I vision something new, I want something different, you know, like it's like I want that thing that I've just visioned, whatever it is, even if it's, you know, some yummy food.
Well, when you say that, again, it makes me think of that opening, and he talks about creator and self-referential loop. And when he talks about it, I got the sense of yearning. When you said desire, how creator so much wanted to have experience, and the only way to do that is it was to for us to arise. We're the new idea. And with us arising, there's a transformation even for creator to experience. Oh, that's a really cool thought.
I like that.
Yeah.
Very good. I know there's lots of smiles going on. Who else would like to share?
I'd like to add to that, maybe to that question. And I think at the end of the chapter, he's kind of like giving the answer when he says, and I'm quoting him here, he says on page 60 top, either way, the story will only proceed, which means the story of resistance and how are we going to pass on to this, when a hidden passageway is discovered. And so, and later he goes on that science only speaks about transformation, like one thing is changing to another, but creation is creating something from nothing. So I think we are overcoming resistance always when we are moving into nothing, and we might not even be aware of it. I think like the example Robbie shared, she might not really completely be aware what got her really out of resistance, but it was definitely not the past, it was not the unconscious, and it was not transformation of changing one thing to another. There was some kind of step into the unknown, a second or a moment where she stepped into the unknown, and then the energy was freed to be active. So I think the idea, or he calls it the unexpected, the idea of the unknown, and that we are going into a level of imaginal, of something we don't know, but we are connected with, someone mentioned that, which helps us to move beyond resistance. And it has to do, I think, also with the information loop, like someone shared, that we may be receiving information from Aleph or from the universe or the spirit, and that helps us to move into the unknown. So he's actually saying, so it's really about going into the unknown, and I really like that, because that book has been written many, many years ago, and now everybody speaks about the unknown. So I think that may be one way to move in beyond resistance.
Thank you. And who else would like to share? Trina.
Off there. There we go. It was on, it was off. So I was thinking about that question, and it makes me think about when we set an intention, and we basically say, this is what we're doing. This is what we want to do. And as soon as we do that, it's almost like the information goes to the universe. The universe starts providing the resources, things start coming in. And our first reaction is, almost like, oh my gosh, it's happening. I mean, it's exciting. But at the same time, there's that resistance saying, this can't be possible, you know, or what am I going to do with this or whatever. And then we say again, we might need this. And then more comes to us. And it doesn't just happen with us in ourselves. I mean, it happens in groups. And I can give you an example when we had come to the realization in our community that we needed to create a new county. And we said, this is the perfect time. We've exhausted all other things. And everyone was like, yes, we need to create a new county. Well, the first thing that started happening was, you know, well, you can't do that because it hasn't happened in 100 years. Or the only way we could get it on the ballot this fast, so close to the cutoff dates, is to get it through the House and Senate, and they need to put it on. But there's only about a week left in the session. There's no way we'll be able to get that. And then there's somebody that comes forward that says, let's just do it. And pretty soon someone else says, yeah, let's just do it. We're just going to do it. Well, as soon as we said, yeah, we're going to do it, all of a sudden it was like, here comes somebody that says, I'm going to sponsor this bill. And then another person comes forward and says, I'm going to sponsor it in this house. And they pleaded it, and it literally went through committee, Senate, committee, House, went for the full vote, and was on the ballot in 3 days. Even though everybody said, never going to happen. So it's almost like once you look at that or you feel that, and then you make that choice and say, no, I'm going to do it, and you put that energy and desire into it, all of a sudden, the pieces start popping. And it's, as I talk about in the book, it's like, oh my gosh, it's happening. Oh my gosh. And then all the old programs, the old, you know, well, this is impossible, or what am I going to do with this, or all those funny little questions. But it happens in a group, not just individually. I'm sure everybody's resistance starts coming up to some things. But that's the way the change happens, especially in activism, is when a couple get that idea and they hold on to it, and the resistance comes in and they're like, no, I'm going forward. And every time you go, nope, I'm going to do this anyway, it seems like that's when the universe starts dropping in everything that you need. And it's so exciting. It's so fun, and it's so exciting. And that's why I think we need that resistance and the awareness around it, the fact that we need to recognize that it's there and say, oh, well, why is that stopping me? And then we make that declarative statement, yes, I'm going to do it. And off it goes. I don't know. It's just a perception of a process I've been in with several times.
Absolutely. It really shows you that the power of intention can override every unconscious program, and that we actually don't need to spend the rest of our lives in therapy relieving ourselves of the unconscious conflict, that we can actually just get very focused on our intention. It's only when that unconscious is pulling attention to units away and you don't know, and then it's actually creating it from an unconscious place. But you're talking about overriding that for power of intention. Yeah, is what I understand anyway. Yeah, very good. And I see Joyce had something to share. And also Margaret, you next, Margaret. So Joyce first.
Yes, I'd like to share what's said on page 57. To overcome inertia, you must release previous thoughts. So this is what Veronica was touching on earlier. The past doesn't even exist at this moment. So we don't want to oppose any thoughts that we're getting. We want to allow them to be expressed. So our feelings of not wanting to experience resistance fits right into this category. Once we accept that resistance is not something that is opposition to us, but is something that we can allow, we can express it. And then, and personally, as I say, this is my favorite chapter. There is such a benefit to develop awareness every time resistance shows up, and then shift the thoughts that we're having about it to the fact this is our opportunity for creativity, and Robbie is certainly one of the most creative people I know. Mm-hmm. So our perspective of resistance being uncomfortable is can shift to the point that we see that if we're starting to feel some discomfort, we're back to what Veronica was talking about. The discomfort's really related to something that we thought was true in the past, but it's just not something that we've dealt with this moment, but welcoming it as a new experience and allowing the creativity to pour out of us, I think, is the message that's here.
Yes. Thank you. And how about you, Margaret? You need to unmute, love. You're muted there.
Oh, I thought I was unmuted. Okay. Hi, everyone. This chapter reminds me of something that grandmother taught us early on, that when you make plans, if you don't see opposition within one moon cycle, within 30 days, either you haven't put it out strong enough, it's not for you, but you need to go back to the drawing board. Because anything that you need to manifest should show resistance within 30 days or moon cycle. And opposition and resistance and things like that, if I embrace it, see it, embrace it, and just allow it, I go through a whole lot faster. I also remember grandmother teaching surrender is a very powerful thing. So when I surrendered to some of the oppositions and some that I'm facing today, right now, the pieces are coming together really, really fast. And everything that I need is really being handed to me. And so opposition, there isn't anything that's going to be done that's going to be powerful if there's not the opposition. And it's part of the creative process to me. And that's my understanding of the inertia of it. It's, it is, and like I do, like what Trina said, when you finally say, yes, you know, I really do want this, I'm really going to do this, you know, things start opening up. It's just a matter of embracing both sides, your creative side, the opposition that comes with it. A lot of people, I mean, a lot of us as human beings, we quit when, so to speak, you know, the being confronted by the opposition. You know, we're like, well, you know, do I really want this? This is too hard, whatever. When you're really decided and real focused on, yeah, I'm doing this, okay? The other thing is that you can plan anything in life, just not the results. So even though you're facing the opposition of the creative process, you also have to be aware that what you originally started may end up in a different place that's even better than you could have imagined, or better than what you originally imagined, because you imagined it. So that's my take on inertia and facing opposition and things, but it is, for me, necessary to grow.
I like that attitude, and I can see how things now flow easily for you, more easily with that acceptance, because I understand when we put another layer on our resistance that we've added an extra resistance to an already resisting state. So, you know, let's just come to peace with resistance, and it's like a natural part of existence, you know.
Like brushing your teeth in the morning. It's like,
yeah.
It's
good.
Yeah. It reminds me of what grandmother says about there's no way to happiness. Happiness is the way. Mm-hmm. And it's the mindset, you know, the mindset we hold in our movement to creation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. It also reminds me of a book that I read. It was called Nickels and Dimes, and I was in a book club. And she, the woman was brilliant. She had like three degrees, a PhD, and she went on to do a research where she did a 6-month research that she was stripped from all degrees, all of her bank accounts, her beautiful car, beautiful house. She was given a poverty or a slightly above poverty level to live on. And as she was going, and in the book, about 3 months into it, about 90 days, she started to identify. She started to forget what she really was and what she really had, and started to identify with everyone in the mindset. And it was a really interesting book on how the mind, she actually started to forget that, know who she really was, that she really was going to walk back into her life 3 months from now and write a book on this. It was just very interesting to see what the mind can do and undo.
Absolutely. And it reminds me of that idea that we become like the people we hang around the most. And I think, it's all the programming that happens and where we can put our attention.
Yes. Yeah. And that's exactly what happened. That's like in AA that I belong to, it says, hang with the winners.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And it's so great to be amongst all of you winners and being on this call with you. And we look forward to when Grandmother can return from her journeys and be a part of this call soon. But unfortunately, it's time now to finish. So if you have anything else burning to say, please come on next week and share again. It's been really great. So it's time to conclude our studies, and we thank you for sharing your time and energy with us. You matter and count. So you always make a difference. We look forward to you being with us next week as we make that leap to greater consciousness. Have a powerful week and allow your light to shine, and always all good things to you.
Oh, thank you.
Way down.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.